From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. In the early morning hours of November 13th, 2022, the small town of Moscow, Idaho, was forever changed when four University of Idaho students were killed. And today, one man sits in the Latah County Jail accused of those killings as he awaits trial next June. As many of you know, this story has garnered worldwide attention. It has spawned numerous podcasts as well as books. And New York Times best-selling true crime author and former New York Times investigative reporter Howard Bloom has also followed this story, and his new book, When the Night Comes Falling, takes us behind the scenes of this truly horrific crime. And Howard is joining us now to talk more. Howard, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for speaking with me.
So, Howard, you have written about numerous true crimes over the years. What was it about this story that really drew you in?
Well, there were two elements at first. First, it was the victims. I mean, to see, it was so tragic. These four young lives of beautiful young kids cut short. The book is subtitled A Requiem for the Idaho Student Murders, and I wanted the book to be a loving remembrance of the lives they lived and the lives that could have been. I mean, one of the victims, Zaina Kernoodle, had on her graduation mortarboard from high school. She had written underneath it, "For the lives I will change. For the lives I will change." And that always stuck with me, because this young woman and all the other victims would never get a chance, the opportunity to affect other lives. So I wanted to do that sort of tribute to them. At the same time, this was a perplexing mystery. There was no motive. There was no logic to the crime, if there could ever be a real logic or rationale to the killing of four young people. There was no murder weapon ever found. There was really no entry that was forced into the scene. All these mysteries made me want to go out to this little town in Idaho and try to see what had happened, try to see what the town was like, try to get in there and tell the story of the people involved in these cases, in this case, the people who were hunting for the killer, the suspect who was arrested, and how the case was cracked by the authorities.
Mm-hmm. So with that said, you traveled to Moscow, and take us through your process of trying to figure out, how this began, even before these murders. I mean, you take us back to even some of the relationship in particular between Michael Koberger and Brian Koberger. Michael is Brian's father. And all of that, but here you are having to try to piece all of this story together.
Yes, and it was particularly hard to put the pieces together because of the gag order. The judge mm-hmm. had, in effect, put in a court order preventing any of the law enforcement officials or the lawyers who had actual knowledge of what had happened to make any comments. I was fortunate that I arrived in Moscow before this gag order had been put into effect. I got there in the early days of the case. And before I had gone out there, I had done some of my homework. I had read the annual police reports from the Moscow Police Department, and they identified a couple of auxiliary policemen who were not members full-time of the department, but were also members of the university. And I could approach them and from their perspective, and they knew how the investigation was proceeding. I also was able to reach out to the department psychologist, to the clergy members of the department, and they were intimately involved as the investigation progressed. At the mm-hmm. same time, once there was a suspect, while I couldn't get in direct contact with the suspect's family, I was able to talk to, in Pennsylvania, relatives and people close to them, people who they had confided to, and I was able to put this picture all together. And I must say, I went out there originally when I first came from Connecticut in the early days of the crime, and there was still no clue to who the suspect was. I thought my I guess, egotism, but I would go out there and try to solve the crime. This was a perplexing mystery. And I got out to Moscow, and I went by the murder house, and I saw how it was a sort of almost in a gully, and there were other houses around it. And I figured out that I would, maybe someone from one of these other houses had seen these young kids partying. It was a party house. And he thought that their ebullience, their beauty, their youth was a rebuke to the repressed life he was living. And I found out that many members, residents of the houses nearby were from a local church group that had problems with the community. The church's deacon had been arrested for pedophilia. 12 young women from the church group had gone on the internet and released videos alleging sexual abuse. And so I started interviewing members of the church, thinking that maybe this would lead me somewhere. And in the course of these interviews, I found out that this church group was against any kind of COVID vaccinations. And 2 days into my investigation, I got COVID. So I didn't at the beginning solve the case. I did get COVID. But after that, when I recovered, I came back and began really putting the pieces together in earnest.
And what was interesting to me, too, about this book is, as you mentioned, there were a lot of people you could not interview because of the gag order. So you did do digging and you found, you know, friends, you know, confidants, other folks. However, you don't name them in the book. And even in your epilogue, you talk about that, that it was, you know, even to this day, no one wants to be named. So tell us about that process, but also how you verify what, you know, who these people are when you cannot say who they are.
I mean, that's a very good question and an important one. What I set out to do was really reverse of what the FBI had done when they built their case. When the FBI builds their case on using DNA to track down the suspect, they did something called investigative genetic genealogy. And they try to work out from this little bit of touch DNA, a family tree, and they worked it out and out until the father's limb on this family tree led them to the suspect, Brian Koberger, who lived 10 miles away from the killings and drove a white Hyundai, which was the car they were looking for. I did the reverse. I started taking this family tree and looking for relatives who were near close relationships to the people involved, and I got them to talk. And it required a great deal of convincing, I must say. And yet I've learned over the years that if you're persistent, and reporters are by nature tenacious, people will eventually want to talk. I just discussed that in the introduction. The problem with that, and I wish it wasn't that way, but this happens all the time in reporting, people just don't want to go on the record, especially in a case where there's a gag order and people are revealing things perhaps they shouldn't reveal. I gave them the promise of confidentiality. I had to protect that, but I did not use anything. I did not use any story unless I could get it confirmed by multiple sources. And when multiple sources close to the individuals involved were telling quite similar and often exact identical stories, I felt confident in using it.
In your book, there were a couple of things that that I think you reveal that maybe a lot of people are not aware of. And one of the things I want to talk about is the FBI's case. And I don't remember if I have the exact date correct, but I believe by December 11th of 2022, so almost a month after the killings, the FBI had done this DNA and they had a name, Brian Koberger. However, the arrest didn't come until what, December 28th, 29th?
29th, yes.
And the FBI though was not sharing this information. So tell us about, and they tracked Koberger across the country, the FBI did. And there's always been speculation about that.
This is one of the great mysteries of this case. As you point out, you know, December 11th, the FBI taking information on the blood DNA taken from a knife sheath, the button on the knife sheath that was left behind. They send this DNA to a lab in Texas called Othram. They then send it back to the FBI laboratory after it's been broken down in Quantico, Virginia. The FBI then builds out this family tree, and on the father's limb of this family tree, they get this person of interest, Brian Koberger. This is on December 11th. At this point, Brian Koberger and his father, who's come out to visit him, are about to leave. The term is over. They're about to leave to go cross country to return to their home in Pennsylvania. At this point, the FBI does not share this knowledge with the Moscow task force. Why not? Well, the one reason could be that investigative genealogy won't hold up in a court of law. It's really, as you can see, not introduced into the police affidavit. They want the Moscow task force not to be prejudiced by this information. And they want them to continue on their own path to identifying a person of interest. They want to be more certain. However, a more cynical explanation, and one that was often shared with me by people close to the FBI investigation, was that the FBI wanted the credit for themselves. They wanted to be the one, after how their reputation had been tarnished in recent years, they want to be the one to make the arrest of this suspect who the whole nation was fixated on. However, once the investigation proceeds to Pennsylvania and they realize it's going to take place on the other end of the country, too many law enforcement divisions and authorities have to get involved. And also, while the FBI was trailing Koberger across country, they lost him for a while, and this scared them. And now they figured they really needed to get other law enforcement agencies involved. And on December 19th, they alert the Moscow task force. And then within days later, the Moscow task force alerts the Pennsylvania authorities, the state troopers, and they are now surveilling the Koberger family. But at the beginning, the FBI was trying to handle this case entirely alone. They were supposed to be working in tandem with the task force. They had a trailer filled with 40 agents set up in the Moscow Police Department parking lot, but they really were two separate investigations, separate but not equal.
And I think, too, and you write about this in the book, that even to this day, we may never know what a motive is, right? If Koberger is found guilty of these crimes. And So talk a little bit about that when you were investigating this, because I think that is still what, for so many people and those of us who live in Idaho, who have connections to the University of Idaho, connections to Moscow, cannot wrap our heads around. Is it's like, how did something like this happen? And maybe a motive will come out, you know, in the trial next June. But at this point, I think that's something that's so difficult to try to process, is that how could something like this happen when we can't even connect him to any of these students?
Yes. I mean, the hunt for a rational motive is really an impossibility. How can there ever be a rational explanation for killing four young people? Add to that, that both the prosecution and the defense have testified in court that they have no evidence of any interaction, either through conversations or on social media, between the suspect and any of the four victims. That said, here's what I believe, and this is my theory, happened. I believe that Koberger, the suspect, had gone to the Mad Greek restaurant, which he was known to frequent in downtown Moscow, and he had seen Maddie Mogan there. Maddie was a waitress there. And I believe they didn't even need to have any real interaction. They might not have even really had a conversation. Koberger was a man who was very comfortable with obsessions. His life was measured out in them. He had been a heroin addict, and then he finds the will to break heroin, to break this addiction. He had been a poor student, then he becomes a graduate student at a world-class graduate school in criminology. He had been grossly overweight. He loses 125 pounds. For some reason, Maddie, her ebullience, her youth, her blondness, her beauty, touched a nerve in him. He fixated on her, and her presence, I believe he had gone by the house, he had seen her, he had checked out where she lived. He felt her youthfulness was a rebuke to the sort of outsider's life he was living. And I think the events that night of the killing, November 13th, show that Maddie was his target. What I mean by that is when the suspect entered the house, he entered on the second floor kitchen door. On the second floor, there were two bedrooms, each were occupied by students. He pays no attention to that. If he were on a random killing spree, he could have gone into either of those bedrooms. Instead, he makes a beeline for a narrow staircase that leads up to the third floor. He enters, there are two bedrooms on the third floor. He chooses to enter Maddie's bedroom. He finds, to his surprise, that not just Maddie is there, but her friend Kaylee Gonclavis, who's been spending most of the term up in Coeur d'Alene. She is there too. He kills Maddie. Kaylee fights back, and he hasn't expected her to be there. She is horrifically, tragically, poignantly collateral damaged in this battle. He leaves behind the knife sheath. He then descends down the staircase, hoping to leave. He then encounters Ethan Chapin, who's 6'4", an athlete, a wonderful young man. And immediately he slashes Ethan with the knife across the neck. Ethan collapses on the floor. At this point, Zaina Carnoodle is awake, and he says to her, it's been overheard, don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you. But of course, he closes in on her. One of the slash wounds she receives is right through her palm, as if she was raising up her hand in self-defense, and he kills her too. These three last killings, I believe, were unplanned, unpremeditated, were simply collateral damage. Then when he leaves that bedroom on his way to leave the house, from another bedroom on the second floor, another student emerges, Dylan Mortensen. At this moment, she sees the assailant. He's dressed in black, wearing a black mask. As she describes it, she's locked in a state of frozen shock, fright. Mm-hmm. The assailant is locked in his own, let's say, armory of hate, his own mania. If she had said one word, if she had cried out, if she had screamed in terror, if she had lunged toward him even, I think she too would have been killed. But because she was silent, he is then locked in his own world. He doesn't even notice her, and he makes his way out of the house, and she returns to her bedroom. That is, I believe, what happened that night. Mm-hmm. And I believe the original target was just Maddie.
You know, as I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, this has garnered worldwide attention. There, I cannot count how many, you know, citizen detectives are out there, how many podcasts there are around this, right? How many books have been written? And I will say that for those of us who are locals, who live in Idaho, as I said, many of us have connections to that area. It is difficult, and it is something that's difficult to talk about, and frankly, I think even report on, because you want to have such respect and regard for these four students who lost their lives and who have touched other lives, right? Everyone has now, so many people have been impacted by this. So as you wrote this book, and now it's in publication and people can read it, What is your hope? What do you hope that people take away from this and from what you've written in, you know, in comparison to everything else that is out there about this?
Well, I try to accomplish really two things in this book. One was, as I said before, to recreate the lives of the students, the victims, to give a tribute to them. But I also wanted to create an awareness for readers outside the story to understand what happened, who the people were involved, the suspect, his family, the families of the victims, and also the police, the hunters, as they look for the subject, and they try to track him down. I wanted to create what I hope is a compelling read about people caught up in a horrible tragedy. It's a story where there really are no survivors. The whole town is damaged. It's a story about victims, and the victims' families are also victims in this drama, as well as I tell the story of Michael Koberger, Brian Koberger's father. He is someone who, in the course of a cross-country trip with his son, comes to the realization, oh my gosh, my son might be a monster. And yet, even though these thoughts are prominent in his mind, he can't quite make the connection. He refuses to go there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate the conversation, and I thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about this, and as well as your perspective and the insight into this case. So thank you so much, Howard.
Appreciate your talking with me, too.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.